We're talking today with Colin Barnett, Premier of Western Australia, ahead of the first Tony Abbott COAG meeting on December 12. Colin Barnett, what will be the main issues that Western Australia will want to see out of this first COAG meeting?
Well, I think the three major issues will be education funding, the NDIS funding, and also whether there's to be any changes to the goods and services tax and its distribution.
Well, just taking the education funding at the moment, there's obviously a big row going on between the states and the Abbott government about the Gonski school reform program. Now, Western Australia never signed up to that, but how do you see that conflict that's underway, and does Western Australia have any place in that dispute?
Well, pre-COAG so-called conflicts are a bit like episodes of Blue Hills. They just go on and on. I would hope that we'll see a different approach to COAG. Maybe that's a different topic. However, in terms of education funding, I think you should always start with the facts in any policy debate. And the simple facts in education are that 70% of children go to state government schools, and state governments fund 90% of the cost of those schools. So that, to me, is always the starting point. I think what came out of the Rudd and Gillard governments became chaotic in a sense. Instead of talking about education principles and how to improve standards of education in Australia, it ended up with the federal government under Labor trying to pick off one state after another with offers of more money. I mean, you cannot have a nationally consistent education system on that basis. So I would hope that Chris Pyne in his role does do what he's saying, go back to square one, and whatever role the Commonwealth might play in school funding, and particularly state school funding, let's get the principles set and let's have consistency across the country. At the moment, we've got inconsistency and that will not work.
Of course, you're in a different position because you didn't sign up, but would it be fair to a state like New South Wales, which fully signed up and was first to do so, to tear all that up and say, well, we're starting again?
Well, they may grizzle about that, but this sort of opportunistic running around behind closed doors, having secret meetings and signing state by Commonwealth agreements, I just think was not good public policy or good practice. So I think at the end of the day, in terms of Commonwealth funding, the Commonwealth will call the tune, and if they want to tear up those agreements, they'll tear them up.
And that's fair enough, you think?
Well, that's the way it's always gone.
Yeah. Now, just on disability funding, what are you looking for there, and where are things up to?
Well, Western Australia did agree, perhaps the last state to agree, on the disability funding, and that was negotiated by myself and Kevin Rudd. And the principle that Western Australia was making was that in terms of disability services, about 80% of them are actually funded by state governments, not the Commonwealth. So there is a structure out there that, not perfect, but works. And we had a view, you don't tear that up. You build on it, improve it, change it if you want to, but you just don't tear it up and throw it away. We're talking about people's lives and people severely disadvantaged. So we wanted to maintain local control, at least through these trial periods. And Kevin Rudd agreed, I think, contrary to most of the members of his cabinet, and therefore Western Australia signed. For the disability scheme, the big problem will be the cost. And I think we'll probably find out around COAG that the cost estimates are way, way above what has even been speculated in the media. And then it will come down to a question, can the Commonwealth really contribute to delivering what it's promised?
So do you have hard information that it really has escalated?
No, I have stronger rumours.
You think are reliable?
Yes, I do. And the states have got a pretty good idea what it costs, and if you're going to expand the scheme, extend it to more people, which is a good thing, the cost is extraordinary.
And this is over the cost estimates of the final days of the Labor government?
That's my understanding. That's what will happen.
Have you any idea, roughly in proportional terms, how much the blowout is likely to
be? No, I can't put a figure on it, Michelle, but my understanding, we're not talking about $1 or $2 billion. This is, if it's to be delivered as it was promised, it's going to cost far, far more, about 50% or more above it. So that will then, as I say, be the issue. Can the Commonwealth fund that? The states will certainly maintain their funding and probably increase it, but at a more moderate rate. So that will be the big issue on disability, is How much is it going to cost?
Over what period are we talking here, the 50% blowout?
Oh, I think that's, over the next few years, yeah, impacting pretty quickly.
So do you think that this could be a real moment for the future of this disability scheme? Because clearly a 50% blowout could not be afforded.
Yeah, well, you are quoting me on the 50%. It's of that order. It's a big blowout. It's not a small one. I'm not putting a figure on it because I don't know. But my concern always has been about this, that, yes, we should be improving services for people with a disability. I don't think there's any argument about that. But at the same time, given the huge cost, I think it was always been wrong to perhaps unrealistically raise expectations. And I think many people in the community with, perhaps not the most severe level of disability, but nevertheless significant disability, may be disappointed at the end of the day. They will not get the level of funding that they think they're going to get.
Now, you mentioned the GST. What do you think the discussion at COAG will be about the GST?
The GST issue will be about widening the base, in other words, taking away some of the exemptions. I personally favour that. I think I would retain exemptions for probably health and education, but they would be the only two areas. I can't see the point of exemptions in other areas. There will be an argument about capturing some of the online shopping, and I think there is merit in that. Because what was meant to be a growth tax is becoming a very modest source of revenue for the states. And for Western Australia, we will continue to bang on about the distribution of the GST. And that's an issue for this state where Western Australians who, like everyone else in the country, pay their GST when they go shopping. This year, only 45 cents in the dollar will come back to Western Australia. That equates to about $3 billion a year loss of revenue to this state. And as I've said publicly for the last two or three years, Western Australia accepts it is a prosperous state. We accept we will subsidise weaker states like South Australia, Tasmania. But there is a limit. And at the moment, virtually all of the cross-subsidy to those states is actually coming from Western Australia. So we happen to think other states can share that burden. And maybe the Commonwealth could pick up a bit of its responsibility, particularly to the territories like the Northern Territory.
I seem to remember that Tony Abbott had rather conflicting statements when he was in Perth and when he was in Tasmania. Where do you think he will come out on this issue?
Yeah, well, elections do bring forward conflicting statements. I'm optimistic that Tony does recognise the situation that this state faces, and I think he recognises if we have similar occurrence perhaps in Queensland, then the two high-growth states of the Commonwealth will have slower growth, and that will have big implications for revenue flow into the Federal Treasury because most of the income generated in Western Australia flows to Canberra.
So you're really optimistic that you can get something out of it?
Well, I'm optimistic that we can get, Michelle, a long-term, say, decade plan. The first thing we'd want to see our miserly 45 cents in the dollar at least stabilise, and then progressively over a number of years increase back up to, say, I've said 75, 65 cents in the dollar, something that I think the public would find acceptable. And that can be done without reducing GST to any state. So it takes a bit of national leadership. And I don't accept from successive prime ministers, well, that's up to the states. That's not a valid argument. This is about the distribution of income within Australia to fund schools and hospitals, isolated Aboriginal communities, roads and whatever else. And it requires some national leadership to do that.
Now, you spoke about the exemptions. What exemptions do you think realistically are likely to go? Because the federal coalition is tied into not broadening the base, not increasing the rate?
Well, if you say no to everything, there's not going to be any reform, and that will be a negative for the future economic development of this country. In my view, as I said, I think exemptions for education and exemptions for health are valid because I think the impost of GST on that would be very dramatic for a large proportion of Australian families. I don't believe exemptions on fresh food, that type of thing, makes any sense at all.
It just seems to me, though, that being so tied into his promise of no change, how could Tony Abbott give ground on that? You think he just should ignore the promise?
That's a political judgment. But if we're to have the GST serve its original purpose as a reliable source of income for the states, there needs to be some reform. And bear in mind, and we shouldn't forget history, The states had a legitimate share of income and company tax when they handed that over during the time of the Second World War. All that happened was the GST replaced that as the source of revenue to the states. So this, in a sense, is states' money. I'm willing to take a bit of public backlash and get on the reform bandwagon, but for Western Australia, as part of that, we want to see some reform in the distribution of it, and that can be a gradual change over a long period of time.
And you'll push this hard at this COAG? You'll go in hard and early on this?
Oh, well, I think the issue is there. It is the number one issue for all of the states. Victoria now quite rightly complains it's starting to lose its share of GST, and Victoria's probably been historically the best-run state. I think they can claim that mantle in terms of, you know, their schools and their health and their budget management. Queensland, which has, you know, a problem, Campbell Newman's inherited a big debt problem, but there's no doubt Queensland and Western Australia are going to be the two high-growth parts of the Australian economy for the next 20, 30, 50 years. And therefore, if Australia is to progress, you want those strong economies to progress too, and stronger.
How do you think federal-state relations will go under Tony Abbott, who at various times has been a federalist and a centralist? And obviously, from what you're saying, you're willing to make a fight of it for things you believe in. What do you see as the overall picture here?
Well, Tony Abbott's told me around this table that he was a centralist, but he is reformed. So we'll see how he goes in a couple of weeks' time.
Do you believe that?
I'm optimistic. I'm always optimistic, Michelle. Look, I think what I, if I can answer in a slightly different way, what I'll be looking at will be the tone of the meeting, in a sense. Now, I think I'm now the longest survivor of COAG meetings of any Commonwealth or state leader. And where, in my view, Kevin Rudd and got off the rails was that, for a start, he obviously enjoyed COAG meetings and he had a lot of them. They were seemed to be every 2 months for a while. And he almost elevated the role of COAG to a parliament. And things were being...
Well, it was supposed to be the workhorse of reform, I think he said at one stage.
Yeah, and I think he overplayed that. We had issues being debated at COAG and signing ceremonies and all the rest of it before he'd even taken some of those issues to the federal parliament, you know, where they involve the Commonwealth significantly. And I don't think COAG should have been ever elevated to that standing. It was almost another tier of government. And then his bigger mistake was, I think, then bringing things into COAG where he had very bad advice, mining taxes and so on. Julia Gillard, I think, just disliked COAG. I think she resented its existence and really didn't want to be there. So Tony Abbott, I would hope that Tony's approach will be to sit down with premiers and talk about some of the bigger issues for Australia and try and get some sort of agreement, common thinking, consensus, if you like, about how we go about education, how we go about the disability scheme, how we go about boosting productivity, and a more high-level principle. Let the bureaucracies go away and work on it. But what we were seeing is issues just being plonked on the table under Labor, agree or disagree, meetings behind doors, with one state after another trying to offer more money and get a special deal. I don't think that's the role of COAG. I think COAG should be, in a federation, national leaders, state leaders agreeing on a direction on major policy issues, and then, yes, send away people to do the detailed work. So it'll be interesting for me, from my point of view, to see what style Tony adopts.
So that is a role that's a bit of a driver of reform, not exactly a minimalist role.
A driver of reform in agreeing on principle, yeah, we can. And we can have broader principles about environmental assessments and how that's done. And Tony Abbott's put that on the table. I think everyone thinks that's a good idea. But let's get the principles right. We never at any stage agreed on the principles, whether it be the mining tax, the hospital reforms, disability, or education. And it's not hard to get five or six intelligent people around the table to broadly agree we need to fix this system, and these are the sorts of principles we'd like to see played out. But we were
It's a bit hard when they come from different states, at least historically, that would be suggested.
But we were getting to the situation, Michelle, where people were talking about detail around COAG. I just don't think that was the role of leadership. Now, if we want to boost Australia's infrastructure and therefore Australian productivity, let's talk about how we're going to go about that. And that's what I'd see, a little bit more of that more, if you like, broad-ranging, philosophical, high-level, whatever you want, cliche people want to use. We need a bit more of that, and a little bit less of arguing about individual Commonwealth state deals on this and squabbling about money. So I hope Tony Abbott, as Prime Minister, brings a higher level of economic and political maturity to COAG.
You mentioned before that you were up for reforms, and there is a bit of discussion at the moment around on how it is difficult to get reform going again because of the media cycle, because people have reform fatigue, a number of reasons. Where do you stand on this? Do you think another big round of economic reform is necessary in this country?
Look, I think there is a job in improving Australia's infrastructure in a whole range of areas, and that does require a good understanding between the Commonwealth and the states. In terms of other sort of microeconomic reform, I think that's going on in a progressive way. I don't think we need to have another grand meeting of the business world or anything like that. What's now been talked about in terms of simplifying environmental processes, not lowering standards, but just simplifying the process, I think that is good. And I think there's other areas that we can do that. Meanwhile, it's often forgotten, the states conduct their own reform. And, just in Western Australia, we're making huge reforms in sort of mining approvals, environmental conditions, retail matters, consumer law. And that's just a continuing task. We've introduced a repeal week in this state where we're just repealing redundant legislation and regulations. So I think, keep the foot on the pedal, but we don't need to have some, let's stop and have the grand vision. I think just keep working hard.
One thing you've done in Western Australia that gets quite a lot of coverage in political circles in the East is your independent state schools. Mm. How's that program going?
It's going well, and there is now 255 independent public schools within the state school system.
How do they work exactly?
Well, they work by the school principal having authority to basically run the school, and that includes employment of staff, a single line budget, so they can make decisions on staffing, the type of staff, the types of programs, where the money goes in the school, and the effect has been very noticeable in improving the motivation of teachers. It's built up school spirit, the community's closer involved. And where we stand at present, about one third of the state government schools in Western Australia are now independent public schools, and that one third accounts for about half of the student population. So I think it's a good reform.
And you'll be extending that?
Yes, and there's several hundred more schools wanting to be part of it. So I can't say yet that we can see clear evidence of improved academic results. But I believe we will. I think they've only been going for 3 years, and I think we'll start to see that come through quite strongly.
There's much talk about the end of the mining boom, the slowing of mining investment and so on. What implications is that going to have for Western Australia?
Well, Michelle, I have always been a mining boom denier. I've never used that word publicly. And I've always said we certainly had a peak in the terms of trade, export prices relative to import prices. But in this state, the big projects are continuing on. We've still got in this state about $170 billion worth of resource projects under construction, and we expect further ones to get underway, big ones to get underway in the next 6 months or so. So we certainly saw a peak in activity, but the mining industry is still extremely strong in Western Australia. I think when people talk about the mining boom being over, it's mainly from the East Coast, because we've seen a sharp decline in coal prices, and the coal industry, the big mining industry on the East Coast, is in trouble. In this state, natural gas, iron ore are very strong, and we're seeing some weaker situations in alumina and gold, but you've always got ups and downs, so I think we're going to see mining investment and mining production continue to grow here for at least the next 10, 20 years quite strongly.
Of all the states, WA is the one that's obviously geographically closest to Asia, but also is closest in economic ties and awareness and so on. How important do you think this battle with Indonesia is at the moment, and where do you see that going? Where are the implications for you, for this state, for Australia generally?
Well, Western Australia's major ties into Asia are primarily China, Japan, Korea, increasingly India. But Indonesia is a very important agricultural market for cattle, which is in the news, but also for grain. It's embarrassing for Australia. It certainly coincides with, obviously, elections approaching in Indonesia. I just hope we see some calm, polite diplomacy, and I think the issue will quietly fade away. But it is embarrassing.
Potentially damaging?
There's a risk of that, but I think if the diplomacy is conducted at the right quiet level, I think probably both countries would like to see this event come to an end.
Does anything more need to be done? Do you think that would a personal conversation between Tony Abbott and the President be useful?
Well, I don't know if that has happened, but I'm sure that will happen. And as I say, I think both countries would like to see the heat come down. It's been a fumble by Australia and an embarrassing one.
Colin Barnett, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.